I am really excited to be here. Very often when we talk about health inequities, rural populations aren't included, so I really appreciate the opportunity. Probably because of that, I was a little overzealous and probably put a few too many slides here, so I'm going to talk fast. This first slide is one of my favorite pictures. This is a picture from Cattaraugus County, New York, 1923. The health department in Cattaraugus County was the first rural health department in New York State, one of the first in the country. It was started by the Milbank Fund as a pilot program to determine whether they could bring the urban protections of public health to a rural setting. So I think there are a few things that are really interesting about that, not the least of which is that public health in rural jurisdictions started in the early 1920s, over 100 years after public health started in urban areas. And that, of course, was as we were starting to get some medical advances, and the shift started to focus more from population to personal health care, and I think a little bit of the focus on rural got lost in that process. I'm going to come back to some of that. So first of all, whenever you do rural work, you have to define what is rural. The problem here is that rural is really defined by exclusion. So basically all of the federal definitions, of which there are 74, try writing a rural grant proposal. Of those definitions, basically they're all defined by what is not rural. So basically you define urban and then everything else is rural. And there are grades of rural, so that you have micropolitan, which is small town, then you have small rural, and then you have frontier, which this is hard to get your head around, is six people or fewer per square mile. Try providing services in those jurisdictions. And then once you aggregate all of that, about 20% of the U.S. population lives in rural areas. So we're still talking about a sizable part of the U.S. population. This is what it looks like on a map, and I show you this because it's important to recognize that most of our country, even though most of our people are urban, most of our country is rural. And the challenge that we face in rural public health is how do we provide equitable public health services, basic public health services, to a population that is this dispersed. And what you see here in the reddish areas are the remote rural, the yellow areas are the small rural, and then the lightly shaded areas are those small towns, those micropolitan areas. So there are a number of social determinants of rural health. I'll go through some of this quickly and come back to some of it a little bit later. There are a lot of socioeconomic determinants, rural poverty, rural economies are struggling, a lot of psychosocial factors. There are a lot of cultural issues in rural communities. There's rural culture in addition to the populations that live in those communities that have their own cultures, a lot of issues around isolation. And then there are societal and community issues, including access to healthcare and access to public health services. Whenever we talk about access, we usually talk about access to healthcare. We also need to be talking about access to public health services. So just in terms of some of the socioeconomic determinants, I'm going to hit you with a lot of graphs along the way here. But basically what we're looking at is a population that on average has about $10,000 less per capita than urban populations. About 31% are on food stamps. Again, remember, 31% of food stamp beneficiaries are rural. And remember that 20% of the U.S. population is rural, so there's an overabundance of individuals on food stamps. 48 of the 50 counties with the highest child poverty rates are rural counties. In terms of educational attainment, rural residents are less likely to have high school have education beyond high school. And only about 20% have bachelor's degrees compared to about 30% in urban areas. This is what it looks like, again, in on a graph in terms of poverty rates. This goes back to 1959. You see that every year, consistently, rural poverty rates are higher. The gap has closed, but it's a persistent gap, and it's kind of stagnated in terms of closing that gap. This is actually one of my favorite maps because this shows where poverty is. And what I like about this map in particular is that you can define different regions of our country by the poverty rates. So what you see here is the Mississippi Delta region, which is a largely African-American rural population. You see the rural South, also largely African-American. You see the U.S.-Mexico border region, a large Hispanic population. And then in the Southwest and the Upper Plains states, you have Native American populations. So a lot of the poverty issues, a lot of the health disparities that we see are an interplay between geography and race and ethnicity. And I think this is an important thing. When you look at data, you see that there are disparities based on geography alone. There are certainly disparities based on race and ethnicity alone. When you combine the two, the disparities are worse. The other region you see here is the Appalachian region. So again, just in terms of some of those unique populations, the Hispanic population is growing very, very rapidly in rural areas. Go to this one. Immigration accounted for 31% of the population increase in rural communities. Again, most of that is Hispanic populations. Some of the states that see the largest gains, Indiana, Oklahoma, these are states that you don't necessarily associate with large Hispanic populations, but that population has increased. A lot of that had begun with migrant and seasonal farm workers, but as populations become more stable, the communities become more diverse, and that creates challenges when you have a diverse community that isn't necessarily reflected by your healthcare and public health systems, and the people who work in those and the cultural competencies creates a real strain on those rural systems that really don't have a lot of excess capacity to begin with. All right, so now I'm going to really hit you with a lot of charts here. I'm going through some of the different rural disparities. This is age-adjusted mortality rates. You notice that in this one, the gap is actually increasing. Since the late 90s, you see that gap increasing widely with the age-adjusted mortality rates higher in non-metropolitan communities than metropolitan communities. You see the same thing for child mortality rates, much higher in the rural communities and the smaller communities. And you see it for childhood obesity. This was work that we did for the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy as they pulled together their 20th anniversary report. I'll tell you in a little bit why we had to do this work, but basically we looked at a lot of secondary data sources. What we saw here was poor self-reported health status for rural residents as compared to non-rural residents. The presence of chronic diseases is higher among rural residents for just about every chronic condition. This one shows hypertension, arthritis, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. This was work that was done by a good friend at the University of South Carolina, Jan Probst, and this she was able to show some of that interplay between race and ethnicity as well as geography. And she was able to show that for blacks, there appears to be this dual effect of race and geography as it relates to individuals who had died by county of residence. This is what I wanted to come back to. So this is a report that was done by CDC, the 2001 Health US report. This is a report that CDC puts out every year. It's the annual data report. This was the first and only year that they looked at rural populations. Each year they try to look at a different population. Data is a real challenge in rural communities. When you have small numbers, it's hard to do good epi work. I mean, we all should get that. This report was really an amazing report for rural communities because it was the first time that we looked at rural data as compared to other data. But it hasn't been done in over 10 years again, and rural communities, as they try to justify grant reports or grant applications, are still using this data. So, you know, if there's anyone here from CDC, redoing this report would be a real, real boon for rural communities. Take every opportunity I can get. So now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about efforts to strengthen the rural public health infrastructure. You know, one thing that we hear sometimes when we talk about rural work is, well, if it's that bad, why don't people just move to urban areas? And I think in some ways we kind of get that, but if we all want to have food and fuel and timber and a lot of the resources that are provided, recreation, a lot of the resources that are provided by rural communities, we need to figure out how to care for rural residents. So this is something, this is probably a lesser known quote from the 1988 IOM report. Most people associate this report with the core public health functions. Those of us in the rural community kind of like this part of it, which said that no citizen from any community, no matter how small or how remote, should be without identifiable and realistic access to the benefits of public health protection, which is only possible through a local component of the public health delivery system. So this was a project that we did when I was back at the University of Pittsburgh, and it was really a first attempt to try to think about what are the key issues that are facing rural communities when we talk about public health infrastructure. Limited resources, financial resources, and those, of course, leading to staffing resources. Recruitment and retention are very difficult. We see that certainly on the medical side, but on the public health side as well. The funding relies more heavily on state taxes and federal pass-through as a proportion of overall funding. That has implications for rural communities. I'll show you the next slide, which actually graphs that. This next point is one that I really, really like to make, and I think it's critically important, and it's very, very overlooked. Many rural communities have no rural public health infrastructure. And this is critical because we think that public health is everywhere, and it's not. There are many rural communities that are not served by the protections of public health. Part of the problem in our thinking on this is that we rely on data sources like the NACHO profile, and as a former NACHO person, I'm very proud of the profile. It's a great data source, but it's a data source of public health where it exists. The people who fill out that survey are local health departments. There isn't anyone to send it to if you don't have a local health department. So we assume when we talk about 70% of the health departments do this, 80% do this, that that's covering all of the population, but it's not. So that's a very important piece to remember. And then there's less technological capacity to receive health alerts. This is the slide I was alluding to. So this was a study we did a few years back on rural public health financing. This is the proportion of funding from different sources, and as you see, that blue line is local support. The orange is state direct, yellow is federal pass-through. Rural communities are more reliant on state resources and federal pass-through, which means they have fewer local dollars to respond to local needs. And I think that that's really the key message here. And of course, as I just said, this assumes that you have a local health department to begin with. So do keep that in mind as well. This is data that came from the NACHO profile. So how do you maintain rural public health infrastructure? Of course, we have some very key challenges right now, a lot of state budget cuts, limited availability of local funding, limited resident support. This is one of the key things that I think we really need to understand better. Residents, I think this is true urban and rural, but it's especially true in rural, which is very conservative in many areas of our country. They have this perception of public health as a governmental institution, and because of that, government is not necessarily good in their mind, and government is equated with taxes. So we're associating public health in their minds with a lot of things that they don't particularly like, and it also goes somewhat counter to a culture of self-reliance. The political support is very mixed. When people understand what public health is, they support it, but very often they don't quite understand what it is. So this is kind of how we tried to conceptualize it. Essentially, the question we have before us is how do we tip the scale? How do we make the benefits of public health, health protection, increased safety, increased health status, how do we make those benefits more compelling than the fear of government, the fear of taxes? What we found, and we looked at a number of states, is the states that were successful in expanding public health infrastructure did it by essentially gubernatorial mandate. So the governors came in as visionaries with their state health officers, and they said, this is not right. We need to change this. This is a human right. We need to make sure people are healthy. And they built infrastructure, which was great, until the next governor came around and said, you know what, I don't like this. So at the same time that you're building this top-down approach, you need to build some grassroots support. And, you know, this kind of starts to sound to me like some of the debate over the Affordable Care Act, too, at the national level, where we were able to get this thing passed through by government mandate, but now people are questioning, well, what's in here? And some of it starts to fall apart when you don't have that grassroots support. So I think there's a good, compelling message there. The other things are to develop public health messaging. We need to be able to communicate to our residents the benefits of public health so that they can then advocate for us. And this is something I hope we'll get into as we have some of our dialogue. One of the things that I really believe is that public health does itself a disservice by not engaging the rural communities, because rural people and rural organizations are the best advocacy groups there are. You know, the National Rural Health Association, I'm on their board. I'm a little bit of the odd man out because I focus on public health. They're out there supporting rural hospitals, making sure they get back, put back in the budget. And those rural hospitals and rural residents, they're connected to their legislators. It's powerful. And to the extent that we don't focus on them or ignore them, I think we do so at our own peril. So we can talk about that more. I think we need more workforce training and capacity building for rural public health workers. And then we've seen a lot that regional approaches do work. That includes networking among organizations, consolidation, whatever it takes. It is harder to provide adequate services when you have a dispersed population. That is a rural challenge. There are strategies through regional approaches to overcome some of those and through partnerships. So I just want to end with a couple more quotes. These quotes, I don't know, I vacillate between whether I find them inspiring or depressing. I look back to the 1920s and 1930s when it seems like we had more support for public health, and it kind of makes me think, you know, our grandparents were a little smarter than we give them credit for sometimes, which I think is kind of inspiring. But if we could get people to say these things today, it would just be awesome, and they don't. So this is from a 1936 Public Health Service report on public health financing, where they said that funds have been so inadequate and so uncertain as to amount that long-term planning has not been practicable. I think everyone can agree on that, whether you're rural or not. The need of a substantial, consistent, long-term program of federal support for the rural health service is recognized by practically all authorities in the public health field. And I'd love to meet those authorities today. And then the last one I have, this was that first slide I showed you, the Child Health is Rural Wealth, the Cattaraugus County Demonstration Project. They did a thorough evaluation of that program, and actually they used what at the time was APHA's public health accreditation tool, which I think is kind of another remarkable thing that we had that back in the 1920s, and now we're moving forward with it again. So at the conclusion of the demonstration, it was shown conclusively that it is possible and practicable to establish a health department in a rural county in New York State, and that such a department can furnish effective services for those living in the county. It has been shown also that county authorities are sufficiently interested in such a service to give it substantial financial support, thus ensuring the continuation of the work. Again, if we could get our county commissioners to say these things 80 years later, I think we'd all feel much better about things. So I will look forward to some dialogue. Thank you. I can tell you what it stands for because it doesn't stay on the slide. Our brilliant communications person, I hope this isn't DK, has told me that nobody will ever ask that question. The first question everyone asks, it stands for National Opinion Research Center. The organization started in 1941 and it has moved on and expanded to other things, so they think that you don't need to say that anymore. But I'm happy with that.